Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Economics, a podcast channel from the New Books Network. I'm Peter Lawrenson, an associate professor of economics at the University of San Francisco. Today, we'll be branching out from the narrow definition of economics to talk about political economy, which is my own specialty. Economists have increasingly realized that you can't just talk about what policies are optimal without thinking about the political response of the people affected and how that may, in turn, change the final policy outcome. And this kind of thinking has brought us into a broader conversation with scholars from other disciplines, realizing there's a lot to learn from them as well. So our guest today is Professor Yao Li. Professor Li received her PhD in sociology from Johns Hopkins University, was a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard, and is now an assistant professor in sociology and criminology, law, and society at the University of Florida. She's going to talk to us about her book, Playing by the Informal Rules, Why the Chinese Regime Remains Stable Despite Rising Protests. This book was published in 2019 by Cambridge University Press as part of the studies of Weatherhead East Asian Institute. It was just released in paperback this year. I've been kind of waiting for it for a while. It was at that library price of $80 or more, but now it's down to something much more reasonable. So I encourage anyone else who, like me, has been wanting to learn more about it to now get yourself your own copy. All right. So, yeah, thanks so much for joining us. First off, why don't you tell me how you got interested in the topic of protests?
Okay, sure. So thanks for having me, Peter. And good to know that the paperback is coming out. I didn't know that before. So how I get started with the project actually is started with my personal experiences. So my mother participated in a protest in early 2000s, and it lasted for several years. And their protest achieved a satisfied success. And then I got interested in the protest because I see that you can achieve something to if you voice your grievances or complaints to authorities. And there is some opportunities for you to achieve success. So that got me interested in starting this project on contentious politics in China.
Well, so how would that work, right? If we think about the Arab Spring or 1989 in China, we usually think of protests in non-democratic regimes as being a threat, you know, something that has to be brought down with, you know, police and tear gas and tanks. And so why is it that, your book says, the title of your book says it all. It says Why the Chinese Remains Stable Despite Rising Protests. So how can that happen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is one of the key questions that I asked in my book. And it's complicated. I want to begin to answer the question by following up with my mother's protest experiences. So for her, the protest she participated, it is about anti-privatization of a hospital used to belong to a large state-owned factory in China. So this protest took place in a coastal city in northern China, so my hometown. And In early 2000s, the hospital, as I said, it belongs to a large state-owned enterprise, was decided to be separated from the state-owned factory. And there are some rules for or some fates of the hospital, whether it is to be privatized or it is accepted or municipalized by the government, city government. So because being taken over by the municipal government would be more beneficial for the hospital employees and retirees. That is the will of the, that is what the protesters, they want the hospital employees and retirees, they want the government to take over rather than getting the hospital privatized. So this kind of economic incentives got these people to take actions, and they took a lot of different matters, and they went through different official channels to voice their opinions and complaints. So the basic claim is that they want their hospital, the government, the local government, to take their responsibilities of taking over this hospital rather than getting it privatized, because according to them, the hospital has made a lot of contributions to the city's development in the past, because the hospital, which belonged to the large state-owned factory, was a major pillar in terms of tax revenues for the local governments. In this kind of claim, they want to justify that the local government has a kind of moral obligation to take over the hospital when the state-owned factory is facing a kind of financial crisis of taking care of the hospital. So in this
let me just jump in here, actually, because I'm thinking that you know, some of our listeners who aren't familiar with China might need a little bit more context. So and correct me if I'm wrong on this. So this is the early 2000s. So the late 19. So officially, China's, you know, economic reforms kind of started in the late 70s, early 80s. But really, the late 90s and the 2000s was the period when a lot of the state-owned enterprises, so like the gigantic, you know, factories with sometimes thousands and thousands of people, were kind of when they realized that they weren't economically productive anymore. And so not only were they, you know, producing things maybe that you know, they didn't need to be so many people working at them, or, you know, they weren't able to produce it efficiently on a global scale, and people were, you know, could find better jobs in the, maybe in the private sector, but also a lot of them had, they were kind of like, even if they were in a bigger city, they were often kind of company towns. So they would provide housing, they would provide hospitals, all the social services weren't actually provided by the government. They were provided by these state-owned enterprises as kind of a branch of the government. So then the question was, you know, how do we break these up into their component parts, you know, and keep the things that are useful, like a hospital. But then you're saying here, the issue was, you know, okay, we don't need to have a hospital that's owned by a steel mill or whatever it was, but, you know, should the hospital now be, you know, owned by the public sector or by the private sector?
Yeah, is that exactly. Right? Yeah, okay. Exactly. So this is the exact background, as you said, Peter, that the whole broader political economic background of the hospital, why the hospital needs to be separated from the big glass factory, and why it also provide a kind of background for these people to want to change the government policy that's taking over the hospital. And I want to mention that falling back to your question about how it is possible, and I want to explain that why people can express their opinions in China and achieve something, and because this is quite different from what we see on screens or from newspapers, as shown in the Arab Spring and other authoritarian countries, that the authorities tend to use tear gas against the civilians and the protesters on the streets. So
I interrupted you in the middle of the story. So why don't we go back to, like, just give us more details about, like, what your mother's colleagues, like, how did they, you know, what were they actually doing over the protests? You mentioned it was over several years, so it wasn't just like one big gathering in the street one day. So what are all the channels that they used?
exactly. So the official channels they use include the petition channel. So across the Chinese bureaucratic system, they build different levels of official offices or petition offices or petition bureaus in charge of taking care of citizens' complaints, grievances, in the form of letter, emails, phones, or personal visits, etc. So by visiting those petition bureaus at different levels of the local government in my hometown, that the protesters, the hospital protesters, they express their opinions clear and loud. And also,
did they go in a large group or like, I mean, if it's just a showing up at the complaints office, then mm-hmm. that doesn't seem to be what I'd call a protest. That's more like, yeah. So. Were they acting as a group or individually or like a letter writing campaign or?
Well, as we mentioned, that it lasted for many years, for several years. So sometimes they showed up in individuals, two or three people, usually the activists. But in many other cases, they showed up in groups like dozens of people, 50 people, and sometimes 100 people. So in addition to using the petition channels, they also took to the streets. So they demonstrate in front of the city hall. And they did this in groups of 100 and 200 and for twice in front of the city hall, in front of the leaders, the city leaders who work the buildings in front of there, and during those demonstrations, they shouted slogans, they chanted international, and they also have some interactions with the police officers. And at different demonstrations, their interactions with the police officers may differ, and this goes into the learning curve of those informal norms, which we can talk later. But anyway, those two demonstrations in a group of 100 and the other with a group of 200 were largely peaceful, and nobody got arrested. Heard, and no major fights took place between the protesters and the local police. And following those two demonstrations, formal meetings between the local officials, largely composed of different officials from different departments of the city government, including the health bureau and financial bureau and etc. Bureau of Civil Affairs and the petition bureau offices. They took part in the meetings with the protesters. And during those meetings, the officials tend to appease those protesters and give them promise of taking care of this issue, paying attention to their grievances and complaints, opinions, and promise to give some response in the near future. And then, so after keep talking with these government officials and keep visiting the official channels such as the petition offices on a kind of weekly or monthly routine, after a total of 6 or 7 years, this case ended up with a success and without a major, without any people were punished. So this is a single case to present for a kind of peaceful resolution of a social protest in China. It's about economic protest. I don't want to present this case as a representative case of all protests in China. And just as my book, Playing Violin Informal Rules, has shown, there are a lot of variations in terms of different types of protests were treated differently by the authorities, and also there are regional differences and also differences across social groups in terms of the dynamics between the dynamic interactions between officials and protesters. So actually, I want to show the complexity of protest and contentious politics in China. And in addition to this peaceful case, there are a lot of violent confrontations between authorities and protesters. And the rationale and the dynamic between those cases can be explained later.
Right. So, yeah, but that's this definitely is, you know, the kind of story that, you know, this we've heard a lot of from China, especially, especially I'd say in the early 2000s. And, you know, that it's really striking to, you know, to Westerners. When we think of, I mean, for instance, like, you know, so what was the government's motivation, right? If we were, you know, in the U.S., you'd say, okay, I'm the mayor of the city. I want to be reelected. If there's, you know, people on the streets, then, you know, they're going to mobilize voters against me. You know, it makes me look bad. I'm going to lose the next election. But these aren't elected officials. So instead, you know, in the news, as we're recording, you know, a Belarusian dissident was plucked off an airplane while he was flying over Belarusian airspace, you know, in a sort of quasi hijacking, as it appears. And, you know, that's kind of what we're more used to thinking, like, this is what real dictators do, right? They find the leaders and they pull them out and they disappear. And then they make a confession on television saying that they were wrong and they're so sorry. And, you know, and also they're being treated really nicely and whatever, right? So why don't, why in this case didn't, the local government, do that with the hospital protesters?
Yeah, I think there are some reasons here. Firstly, the pressure. There are some pressure coming from above, from the central government. So the central government is very attentive to maintaining regime legitimacy and stability. They intentionally and repeatedly call for use of cultures. Call for cautious in dealing with the protests that are considered not antagonistic. So some protests are like the economic protest, like my mother's case. And another kind of reason to explain why local officials sometimes are lenient to protest is that sometimes these officials, including police officers, they are invited in the local community. For example, in my mother's case, when they were demonstrating in front of the city hall, the demonstration I took part in 2007, actually, 2011, actually a police officer entered the protester group and started to have a chat very friendly with the protester. It turned out they knew each other for a long time, and they were just using this opportunity to catch up with each other. So, and there are also other reasons. For example, the protesters, their claim are in line with the local officials' interest. For example, if this in one city or in a district of the city, the local officials, they want to develop the tourism in that region. And but the city government or provincial government wants the waste incineration facility or other kind of environmentally sensitive project to be built in the city, in the region. Then it will cause concerns, not only among the local residents, but also by the local officials who want to develop the tourism industry. Because having a kind of environmentally sensitive project may undermine their effort to develop the tourism industry in the locality. So in this case, then the interest of the protesters and the local officials are similar. So in this case, the local officials may secretly support the protesters. So the reasons can be complicated, and they can come from both the top down, and the other forces can come from the local officials, their own interest. And finally, the last reasons can be explained by the protesters. So many protesters in China, they impose self-censorship. So, for example, they don't make claims for overturning the Communist Party our building a Western democracy, calling for a Western democracy in China. They want to separate certain regions from the communist rule. So when they try to refrain from making very radical political claims, and they try to maintain peaceful and do not establish links with other protests, in many cases, these protests who self-impose self-censorship can have some space for negotiation and having a dialogue with the local officials.
Okay, right. So you're starting to get into like what are these rules? Maybe before we go further into that, why don't you tell us more? So, you know, you gave one example of a protest, but obviously, you know, this is a work of social science, not journalism. So, and, you know, this was your motivation, but like, tell us like how many of these protests are there? Mm-hmm. You mentioned also there's different types, but like broadly speaking.
Well, the official number is not, the recent official number is no longer available, but according to some researchers, the number they found is that by 2011, around 500 protests took place a day, and the total number for 2011 is 182,000 cases. So that means 500 a day, protests a day. And so you can see that the social protest is really a kind of dramatic event taking place in China in the past several years. And this kind of a change is very unprecedented, because in the popular cited number in 1993, only 8,700 cases took place. And in just a few years, the cases just grew skyrocketedly.
So, and so this is kind of numbers that have been leaked from official sources from at various points, but in the past 10 years, they've been a little bit tighter with not letting out this kind of data. Is that the story?
So, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, and that's an amazing number, especially, you know, when you consider the growth rate, you know, under 9,000 to close to 200,000 per year. You know, even obviously, you always want to be careful in China, you know, a country of more than a billion people. There's a lot of things that can go on without, you know, can get large numbers of anything, even with things that seem uncommon. But certainly relative to, you know, our preconceptions of authoritarian regimes, that's a really remarkable fact. So why don't you go into now, like what are the rules? You started on this, but what are the rules that apply, like and who imposes those rules also?
Mm-hmm. So I think that who imposed those rules? So those rules, I want to say that they were generated by the interactions of protesters and the officials. So what are those rules? So these informal rules, which I emphasize in the book, is that they are unwritten. So they are at odds with the formal written institutions, the formal laws, but the informal rules or unwritten rules, they are known by both protesters and the officials. So some examples of those informal rules include peaceful, disruptive actions or demonstrations, protest, sometimes in many cases can be tolerated. So, and also, if you follow the official rules, even you are engaging in an illegal gathering, you can still be tolerated. And if you listen to officials at the protest, at the demonstration. So, for example, in the case that I illustrated in my mother's protest case, so in those demonstrations, they didn't get the permit from the Public Security Bureau. According to the Chinese law, demonstrations, marches, and other types of gatherings are required to have a permit issued by the Public Security Bureau. But
if they asked for a permit, could they get one? I mean, why not just ask for one?
Yeah, they can rarely get one. In my interviews with the police officer, he basically said they never issued those kind of permit. And he said that it's actually illegal to take to the streets and demonstrate. And but there is also a very rare exception. So in another protest case that I investigate, the workers, when they want to demonstrate in their own residential compound, they actually get the permit, but they were required to stay in the residential compound without taking to the streets. So, but very rarely these people can get a permit for demonstration and marches. So in this case, many demonstrations and marches in China on the streets are illegal. And
okay. Yeah, so they're illegal, but they do them anyway, and it's fine.
Yeah, exactly. And I do have qualitative and quantitative evidence for this in the book.
Okay, so how do police respond to this? So you said, you know, when people follow the rules, or at least, you know, in the hospital case, you know, they followed the rules and the police were, you know, pretty gentle, and ultimately the government actually gave them what they wanted, maybe because the local government was actually happy to have it. So having popular pressure kind of let them talk to their bosses and say, hey, this is what the citizens are protesting for, and why don't we just go ahead and give it to them, because, you know, it'll make less trouble. But you said it's not always that way. So what happens when things go wrong? When is there violence, either by protesters or by the police?
Yeah, so I think that there are several reasons for things didn't go well. So on the police side, maybe they received the order from the officials, from the city government, for example, that they don't want these people to be on the streets. And at the same time, the government don't want to make any concessions. At this time, under the pressure from the city, local governments, local officials, then police may use violence. They want to clear the scene. And so this is one possibility, one scenario. And another one is that when protesters go violent, the interactions of police and protesters go violent accidentally. And for example, when the protesters, they see the police presence or the police actions as illegitimate. For example, if they engage in very rude, or they want to arrest some citizens, especially some elderly citizens, then this can escalate the conflicts quickly and may start a violent confrontation between the protesters and the police. And so there are different scenarios, especially when there is a large gathering, large demonstration taking place. So, and also in some cases, some people would argue that some plainclothes police infiltrate the protester group and try to start a trouble, and then try to give the police an excuse for using repression against a peaceful, original peaceful protest. So the reasons can be complicated.
Okay. So, all right. So, you know, they can, the protest can happen, you can get what you want. I mean, so tell me again, why is it that, you know, I guess you gave one reason was maybe the local government wants to have leverage with the central government and say, hey, look, the people are demanding this, you know, we really got to give it to them. Why is it that, you know, from the central government perspective in Beijing, you know, if they see, you know, why shouldn't they just fire that guy? If they say, okay, you're the mayor of this city, you're supposed to keep control, and you're letting people protest in the streets, then, you know, and it's illegal, so you're fired. And, you know, the next guy is going to go in and, you know, and his job is going to be to, you know, bash in some heads and arrest some ringleaders and make this thing go away. Why not do that? We certainly see that, you know, many, many authoritarian regimes around the world, even sometimes democracies, you know, they're pretty happy to do whatever it takes to get people off the streets. What is the advantage to the regime of letting people engage in this popular protest?
Yeah, so again, I think that the central government is concerned about regime stability and regime legitimacy. So many protest claims are in line with the central government's policies. So they are using, as many studies have shown, Chinese studies have shown, these protesters, they are using the law and also the government policies to justify their claims and their demands. And it's really hard for the government to simply deny these protesters who are using using the government policies. On the other hand, the central government, I think when they are facing different protests with similar claims from different regions, it's really hard for them to ask local officials in multiple places to use repression against those protesters. And also this is against their directives and their guidelines on dealing with the citizen protest. One directive that is mentioned in the book is contradictions among the people. So for contradictions among the people, for this type of contradictions, the central government really wants the local officials to be cautious when using violence. So they don't want them to be harshly repressed because for contradictions among the people were considered as a kind of legitimate legitimate contention. So they think that this either workers, peasants, or students, or ordinary citizens, they have some kind of legitimate demands. And when these people are voicing their grievances, local officials should not simply use harsh repression and use coercion against them. So this is also a kind of concern by the central governments to maintain regime legitimacy.
Okay, but let me push back on that a little bit. So if we say, you mentioned this idea of contradictions within the people, which is something from Chairman Mao's thinking, or at least what he said he thought. But he said that, which sounds nice, like, okay, not all contradictions or disagreements among, the people are antagonistic. We're not all enemies. Sometimes we can disagree honestly, and we should be, calm and measured about that. But, you look at what he actually did, and he was not a nice guy with people who disagreed with him a lot of the time. He was not open to popular feedback about when his policies were not, even when they weren't achieving the outcomes that he said he wanted to achieve, like, China's development and the benefit of the Chinese people. He was not open to hearing from his colleagues or from the citizens about that. So, clearly not all Chinese governments have followed that rule. So it seems like there's some motivation there. And then I guess the other thing is, yes, once they're on the street and, being covered by the media and people are learning about the protests, they could say, well, yeah, gee, what they're protesting about, ordinary citizens might say, that seems pretty reasonable. Why don't you just give it to them? Because it's legitimate and it's in line with the government objectives. But again, that assumes you let them get on the street. I mean, if you send a clear message from the start, like, you stay home, or, the whoever we can pick out as a ringleader is going to be arrested, plus the media is not going to cover you because, we can control that. Why shouldn't they just suppress everything?
Mm-hmm. So actually, this is a question concerning about the costs and risks of using repression against our contention, our protest. So according to the current literature in comparative politics and the social movement studies, repression sometimes is very has a high cost and is very risky. There is no concrete relationship between repression and protest. So numerous studies have shown that repression can increase or decrease protest, and the directions between protest and repression can be diverse, and you don't know whether repression can be always effective. So maybe it can be effective on this protest, but not on other protests. And if you only rely on harsh repression against the protest, then it requires the personnel and economic and the financial resources for doing so. You need to find people, employ people, dispatch police officers, military, and other security forces to constantly impose a severe sanction against the society. This is a very high, this is not sustainable for maintaining rule. And for many leaders in authoritarian countries, they have noted realized this, and there are some recent studies showing that these authoritarian leaders, they are becoming more smart in terms of dealing with issues, and there's a learning curve among these rulers in terms of how to use a less risky and less costly method in dealing with protesters. So part of the book also talk about different types of repression in dealing with the contention. So in addition to using arrests and using police or military force, there are a variety of softer means in dealing with the protests, including internet hacking and relative repression, as Oberon and Zheng Yanhua has elaborated, and also some other less obvious, less overt means to deal with the repression. And another mean for dealing with the contention is to prevent its occurring in the first place. So authorities can also use preventative measures to deal with the contention. So it's not just overt or harsh repression that the authorities are taking into consideration, but also a number of other means for dealing with the contention. And in terms of why these authorities, they don't just use the harsh means, as I said, that both the central government and the local government find it's costly and risky. So that's not an option for them to deal with every protest. But I'm not saying that they don't use them at all, as my book shows that they do use in some cases.
Right. So you mentioned in your book, there's, you know, what we've been talking about mostly so far is regime engaging protest. But you mentioned there is also regime challenging protest where they're really breaking all these informal rules. So just to set up the contrast, could you talk us through, you know, some of the key examples of that and you know, why, how mm-hmm. they're different and how the government's response is different?
Right. So I categorized protests in China into two camps. One is regime engaging protests and the other is regime threatening protests. So the key difference between the two types of protests is that for regime engaging protests, both authorities and protesters, they recognize the legitimacy of the other side, and they are open to negotiation and dialogue. By contrast, in regime threatening protests, neither officials nor protesters recognize the legitimacy of the other side, and they close the door, or they are not willing to engage in dialogue and negotiation. So examples of regime engaging protests include my mother's case. In that case, you see that authorities and the protesters, they have a lot of dialogue with each other, although the dialogue can be sometimes contentious. But anyway, they have dialogue with each other, and the conflict was resolved within the official channel. And but one example for regime threatening protest is the Falun Gong protest during the late 1990s and the 2000s. So in that, Falun Gong is a quasi-religious group. So Initially, the Chinese government was supportive to the Falun Gong's development, but over time, when the Falun Gong has attracted millions of followers across China, and it also staged a very dramatic event. That is, they besieged the Zhongnanhai, which is the residential compound for Chinese leaders. They work and live there. So when they besieged Zhongnanhai in 1999, the Chinese officials, they really fear that Falun Gong is becoming most threatening to the regime's rule, and then began to stage a nationwide crackdown campaign against the Falun Gong practitioners. And since the state issued the crackdown order, Falun Gong practitioners becoming more transgressive and use more use of a variety offensive way to stage their grievances. And then the confrontation between the officials and protesters become more ugly.
So, so you certainly still see the Falun Gong in the U.S. You know, they're often protesting outside Chinese embassies. They have the Shen Yun performances where they sort of have dressed it up as traditional Chinese dance performance, and then have a little propaganda element at the end about how the party is bad. And they have newspapers which have been, I guess, increasingly prominent in spreading at least poorly substantiated, negative information about the party. But all that's outside the country. It seems like, I mean, within the country, is there anything? It seems like within the country, it's been pretty successful. I mean, is there anything left, threatening the regime? You know, now that they've had this, crackdown for, over 20 years now.
So actually, there are some, I think the Falun Gong practitioners, they largely turn underground their activities. They, for example, we do still see some resistance, but it's very kind of underground resistance and overt covert resistance. For example, you can see on renminbi, on the Chinese currency, maybe 1 yuan, it says Falun Da Fa Hao. That is Falun Falun Gong is glorious, is good. Or in the walls, residential walls, you can see similar slogans. Falun Da Fa Hao was painted on the walls, and but it can be blurred quickly, be cleaned by local people. So those kind of actions, activities were still engaged by some Falun Gong practitioners. And then my mother told me stories that when they were waiting at the bus stops, some people, middle-aged women or older women would came to talk to them and tell them how Falun Gong is good or something like that.
Okay, so they're pretty deep underground, but they're still active at some level. That's fascinating. So I didn't ask you much about your methodology at the start, so I neglected to do that. But so you had a combination of data work and then field work in a few locations. So I know, one of the things you got out of this is that the rules are kind of not exactly the same for everyone. There's differences across regions, across the city folk versus the country folk. So why don't you sketch out what some of those differences are?
Right. So according to my quantitative research, I do show that peasants tend to be repressed. Peasant protests tend to be repressed compared to other social groups, people's protests. And also minorities protests, especially by Xinjiang and by Uyghur and Tibetans, tend to be repressed compared to other people. And also urban protests tend to be tolerated compared to rural protests. And then I elaborate on this regional and social groups differences in chapter 4 of my book by showing that for the same claims, that is against opposition to waste incineration in different locations, two in rural areas, two in urban areas. And in the rural areas, they were by peasants. In the urban areas, they were staged largely by middle-class professionals. The dynamics, the interactions, and the protest space for these different groups and the locations, people, they differ. But in general, the authorities are more tolerant of urban middle-class protest compared to the peasant protest. There are some reasons for this. One is that the middle class people, they have more resources. They have more economic resources due to the rural-urban gap in China's development over the last six decades or so. And also these middle class people, they have more access to the media. So some protesters, middle-class professional protesters, they themselves are work in the media industry, or they know somebody who work for the media and the outlets. And also some in some rare cases, these people, they have connections with political elites. So then they can rely on those political capital or social capital to make their cases heard to hire Chinese officials, even Chinese leaders. And so these economic, social, and political resources are owned by these middle-class professionals and not tend not to be seen in the Chinese peasants. And so those are some of the reasons. And another reason is that for the police, I mentioned that if the local officials or the police officers, they are embedded in the local community. For example, they learn the police officers, they personally learn, know the protesters. They tend to be more lenient towards the protesters. So if the protesters are the police officers, neighbors, relatives or friends, they tend to be sympathetic to protesters. And for the Chinese police officers, they often, until very recently, they largely reside in the urban areas. And they tend to be identify themselves as urbanized rather than peasants. In this case, they tend to be more sympathetic to urban middle class professionals who the police officer would think that they belong to this group of people rather than showing the similar sympathy to the rural peasants.
Okay, so if there is a protest in a village over some issue, probably the people who'd be, if anyone is asked to crack down on it, it'd be someone who's actually is themselves someone who's relatively more urban and maybe views these people as kind of, you know, country folk who don't deserve respect and who they don't have any personal connection to. And then I think you're also saying that, you know, obviously, you know, in the countryside, people are more removed. They don't have connections to the media. They, you know, if you do protest in your little village, no one's going to see it. Whereas if you protest on the streets of Shanghai, then everyone's going to learn about it. So they also have less resources to sort of mobilize the media on their behalf and get popular support that might give them more leverage.
Yeah, exactly. I want to add one example here is that, for example, in environmental protest, when the local residents they are opposing an incineration plant in their neighborhood, they even get the local police officer on their side. So because the local police officers, they also fear the incineration projects and its environmental hazards, and they think that they are also potential victims in the future. So in this case, it shows that the local police officers can feel what the protesters fear, so they share the similar grievances as well.
Okay, great. Well, this is fascinating. So now your data is mainly from the period when Hu Jintao was China's top leader, so roughly 2002 to 2012. And new research, but you know, certainly the general narrative is that everything has changed with Xi Jinping, and everything's much more repressive. A lot of these areas for openness, not just in sort of tolerance for protests, but also in terms of, you know, investigative journalism or, you know, other kind of participatory formal institutions, have all been suppressed relative to the past. So have you updated, or do you have a sense mm-hmm. of you know, how are things going now relative to the period when you did your field work?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. So in terms of the protest, so I did update my data set to the early C era. So based on the same coding method and the same data set, we extended the data to the 2015. And our regression analysis shows that still the same types of protests that tend to be tolerated during the Hu era are tolerated during the early Xi era. For example, disruptive, peaceful actions tend to be tolerated, and economic and environmental protests tend to be tolerated compared to protests making radical political claims. And the protests with no links to other protests tend to be tolerated. So the pattern you'll see are still the same. And also between 2013 and 2016, I also did some interviews with the protesters, especially those who oppose the incineration projects in their own neighborhoods. And in my interviews with these people, they still, I still see that as the official toleration of public demonstrations. And but on the other hand, in the newly published paper by me and Manfred F. Strom, we found that during the early Xi era, our data set shows that if the state has a higher capacity for using coercion, then they tend to use that capacity. That is, they translate their coercive capacity into repression. But this kind of positive relationship between coercive capacity and repression is not seen during the Hu era. So there are some differences, but there are some continuity during the, at least during the early Xi era. I would say there is still some the informal norms still work during the at least early Xi era, but the extent of the space for toleration may differ. But I don't have data on that, so that is kind of my speculation.
Sure. No, I understand. Yeah, I mean that's again, we're not journalists, but always, you know, it's interesting to see, you know, how things. We sort of identify, oh, here's this great system, and we can see why it works. It makes total sense in one era, but then, you know, the world keeps changing, and so sometimes our explanations that seemed really great a while back may not. But there is also, you know, it's tricky to, you know, in reporting, it's always more interesting to have the story that stands out. You know, so the activist type who, you know, wants to bring, you know, change to the regime that Americans, you know, might be supportive of, you know, democratization or whatever, their story is the ones that are most interesting to, you know, appear in the New York Times or any, you know, media, a Western reporter going around in China. So we hear about those, but, you know, at this point, maybe another little anti-pollution protest in a village that doesn't get repressed, you know, might not make the news. So that's great. So tell me, more about what you're working on now.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm working on two lines of projects. So one project is kind of tied to what to your comments, which is about the media reports on protests in China. So my this project is about comparing media framing of protests across countries. So I'm working with some graduate students. To compare protests, the New York Times coverage of some similar movements in France, the United States, and China, and see how the media report them using different framing devices or framing tools in their coverage. And the second line of my research is about waste management in China. As Peter, you may know that China is in recent years staging some some very high profile waste resorting campaigns in different regions in China. The one of the most high profile campaigns in Shanghai, and recently, more recently in Beijing. And these waste resorting campaigns not only took place in large cities, but also in rural areas. So in this, my second book project, I want to compare different waste resorting campaigns across China in both rural and urban areas.
So like resorting, like recycling and like separating your plastics into your banana peels. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So like how they're trying to convince Chinese, I guess I'd call them consumers or citizens to, not just dump everything into one bin, but be like we do here in San Francisco, where we've got two or three different bins and we want to have everything in the right place, so it can be dealt with as in the most
right.
eco-friendly way possible. Okay.
Right. And some local officials are treating the San Francisco model as a kind of way to deal with the garbage in their own locality.
Okay. Well, that's it's good to know some people still think San Francisco is a model. We definitely have our own complaints. But yeah, well, that's great. I mean, you know, certainly in the area of environment, there's is one of the areas that remain where, you know, the U.S. and China have so much to gain from learning from each other and cooperating for sort of the common goals of protecting the Earth, even if we disagree about a lot of other stuff. So as last thing, I wanted to ask you for recommendations about anything that you want to recommend to our listeners.
So one recommendation I have is related to my second book project. So this is a documentary I want to recommend, which is titled Plastic China. So it's not quite new. It's it came out in 2016. And but I highly recommend it because it is rumored to have influenced the Chinese leaders' decision on banning certain plastic importing from other countries. So Plastic China, it tells the lives of Chinese families who make a living by recycling plastic waste imported from other countries, including America, some European countries, Australia, etc. Mm-hmm. And it shows a human face of, and also the environmental and the human cost of recycling or dealing with those imported plastic waste.
Oh, great. That sounds fascinating. Is there an English subtitled version of that?
Yes, it is. And it also showed when I was a postdoc at Harvard.
Okay,
so,
great.
Yeah,
well, I'll put a link to it in the show notes.
Yeah.
And you said you had a second? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have another recommendation, which is not about China and not about environmental issues, but it is about the development issues in the Islam world, in the Muslim world. So the book that I recommend is titled Islam, Authoritarianism, and Underdevelopment. It's published in 2019 by Amit Kuru. So I think that the book impressed me because of its giving very unexpected answer to the normally posted question, which is about the underdevelopment and authoritarianism of the Muslim world. Well, the author clearly knows a lot, have a very impressive knowledge about this issue, and he goes to the deep history to give us an answer for this about the underdevelopment and authoritarianism of the Muslim world. So any people who are interested in learning about this issue can look at the book.
So now I'm curious, at the risk of obviously oversimplifying it, could you give me the two sentence version mm-hmm. of what is the author's thesis or what aspects is
so basically he's going to the history as deep as early as the 11th century, and he's seeing that from the 11th century the alliance between the Muslim religious scholars, their alliance with the military forces. This kind of joining forces prevent the development of intellectual freedom and also democracy in the Muslim world. So that is the answer he gave us.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, that'd be interesting to read. I certainly heard, and I like that it's not, there's a sort of always a fear of kind of cultural reductionism, like, a specific religion or, whether it's Confucian culture or Islam or something, they are this way because they've always been that way and they can never change. But I think this emphasis on a more of a political alliance is interesting and, kind of provides an understanding of why there might be continuity, but also maybe some hope for paths towards positive change. And it's interesting because I guess my very ignorant stereotype was that the Islamic world was a little bit more intellectually free, for a period of time, at least compared to, Europe in the Middle Ages, which was really oppressive and constrained. So it's interesting to hear that there are elements where it's been a lot of continuity there. All right. Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to tell everyone about your book. Really enjoyed having you on the show. And good luck with everything.
Thank you. My pleasure.